and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community and listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans.
This week, a preview of the forthcoming 2014 Arctic Human Development Report. Scientists from across the North present their findings on sustainable human development in the circumpolar world. You'll hear from Gail Fondahl, Peter Schweitzer, Lee Husky, Gary Kofinas, Diane Hirschberg, and Andre Petrov. This panel was recorded at the UAA-APU Consortium Library on September 19th. It's been edited for broadcast. Gail Fondahl of the University of Northern British Columbia starts us off with an overview of the 2014 Arctic Human Development Report.
Okay, well, thank you very much, and I'd like to start off by recognizing our presence on Dena'ina land here today, and also to say that I would really thank the UAA for hosting a really wonderful meeting so far, the Arctic Frost meeting, but also giving us this opportunity to talk about Arctic Human Development Report here. And I also want to extend apologies from Joan Nyman-Larsen, who is the lead of this project from Iceland, who could not be here tonight. She wanted to, but it didn't work out with her travel schedule. I'm a co-lead on this project along with Henrietta Rasmussen from Greenland. And as was stated, I'll just give a quick overview of the report. And I want to put it into a historical context. The first circumpolar assessment of human development was done 10 years ago, Arctic Human Development Report. We're now starting to call it the first Arctic Human Development Report. And this was a project out of the Arctic Council. And what it did is it provided a baseline of human development in the Arctic. And it called for a updating of that from time to time. It didn't specify that. But it led to another set of projects, one project that had two phases. It was called the Arctic Social Indicators Project. And this was all about tracking and measuring human development in the Arctic. And the idea was that there are a lot of development indexes, including the most well-known one, the UN Human Development Index, but they don't really work all that well, or they don't work 100% well in the Arctic. So we need to develop some Arctic-specific measures of human development. And there were three areas that were specifically acknowledged in the first Arctic Human Development Report as important: closeness to nature, cultural viability, and control over one's fate, as things that were not measured in the Human Development Index. And so there was a three-year project in terms of developing some ways of measuring these indicators, of which many people in the room were involved, and another three-year project in terms of test driving them in six areas of the Arctic. And that continued on to the Arctic Human Development Report 2. And so it was about 2010 where we started talking about the need for a decadal revisiting of what was going on. And obviously, with the first one just being a baseline, you can't talk about trends and all that. We wanted to start looking at trends of human development in the Arctic. And so the Arctic Human Development Report, like I said, 2010, there was talk. It really got going in 2011. And several of us in this room have spent a good chunk of time in the last 3 years working on this. There are 27 lead authors. These authors were responsible for going out and getting contributing authors who had expertise in areas that they might not have. How many contributing authors does your chapter have? Seven, 12, eight, 15, 12?
There's
yeah.
A bunch of
so
them.
Some chapters have none, some of them have whole coteries. And then I also wanted to point out the target audience. In the first report, the target audience really was the policymakers and the Sustainable Development Working Group of the Arctic Council. What we found was, or what they found, because I was just not involved in that except for a tiny bit, was that UArctic and other educational institutions, and probably the University of Alaska Anchorage, picked this up and started using this. And they became as an important audience or a user as the policymakers. And so we have a bunch of different audiences that we're targeting this to. We've tried to write it in lay language, accessible. But the Sustainable Development Working Group of the Arctic Council is following this very closely and is calling it what they think will be a quote-unquote roadmap to prioritization of their activities coming down the pipeline. These are the objectives of the report. First of all, to provide an update to the 2004 report so we can start looking at trends. Obviously, the third human development report, which we all assume is going to happen, will be able to start doing a better job of that. To compare and contrast the cultural, economic, political, and social conditions in the Arctic. I should mention that there have been a lot of assessments of the physical and natural world of the Arctic, and this really, the first human development report was the first base assessment of human development in the Arctic, so this is allows us to continue that trajectory. We're very interested in the both the physical and the social global change that has happened over the last 10 years. So there's been a lot of emphasis on climate change and environmental change. Globalization has been a huge issue too. And so we want to really underscore that as much as the physical change. So those are our objectives. These are the chapters and the authors, and the folks there in highlighted in yellow are the folks who are sitting in this room. And we're going to hear from most of them, but we're not going to hear from Tim Heleniak or Chris Southcott, but they're both here. So if you have questions about the globalization chapter or the population migration chapter, you can find them afterwards. So that's a layout of the chapter, but I'll give that to you again. I wanted to say a little bit about what has changed between the two reports. So the yellow sort of highlights what has changed. In the first report, we had a chapter on populations. We didn't pay as much attention to migration. And migration has been a huge issue over the last 10 years. So that's really much more highlighted in Tim's chapter. The first report had a chapter on cultures and societies, societies and culture, and the decision was made that it really was important to talk about identities. And so societies have been sort of moved out into the community viability chapter, which comes later, and and there's a much bigger focus on cultural identities and the changes in those over the last 10 years. In terms of a chapter, we had a specific chapter on international security in the original report. That's been sort of merged into the political system and geopolitics chapter. We felt that it was important to talk about security, but not only military security. And in fact, military security is a fairly small part. We really wanted to talk about things like food security and water security and energy security. And so those permeate throughout the report. The education and human capital chapter took what was an education chapter and actually expanded it to talk about both formal education and informal education, and also the whole issue of human and creative capital, which Andrei Petrov has been instrumental in developing. I don't think there wasn't a chapter on globalization in the last report. Chris Southcott, who's here, he and another colleague have developed that. That was really important to this report. We added adaptation as more of a focus to the community viability chapter. We did something which I think was rather brave, and maybe it was doable because we had one female lead and two female co-leads, which is toss out the gender chapter. And I'm not sure this could have been done if we weren't all female. But the idea that we had was that the gender issues are so important that they should not be dealt with in a separate chapter, but they should permeate all the chapters. Guiding questions, these were what we asked the authors to deal with. We asked them to look at how the Arctic differs from the outside world and also the heartlands of the Arctic states. How do these different identities, indigeneity, ethnicity, geography, not an identity, age, gender, affect experiences and the perceptions of change? What are the impacts of climate change? How much variance is there across the Arctic? And we are calling the report the Regional Processes and Global Connections. So we're really trying to focus on those two issues. And trends and all that. And then we said to all the authors that we've got three cross-cutting themes. Gender, we wanted everyone to deal with gender. everyone to deal with climate change, environmental change, but climate change specifically, and everyone to deal with globalization. Even though there's a separate chapter on globalization, we felt it was really important to talk about globalization. I thought I'd just give you a quick recount of the process. There was the authors were chosen through a nomination process that was open across the Arctic. There were calls out. States actually nominated individuals through the Arctic Council. Individuals nominated folks. And then from that, we put together a team that was partly constructed about, well, obviously, geographical representation from all the Arctic states. But also, we wanted to have both authors who had been involved in the old report and authors that were new. So it was a balance there. We failed miserably on getting very many First Nations or Indigenous authors. That was pointed out to us. We tried, but a lot of the Indigenous folks that we approached have very full schedules or committed 210%. And what the permanent participants of the Sustainable Development Working Group suggested was that since a lot of folks could not commit the time to this in terms of writing, use them at the review process. So I'll get to that in a second. But anyway, so we invited the lead authors, and we established a steering committee, which had Indigenous presence on it, or has, I should say. And then these chapters were drafted, and then they were internally reviewed at the first draft, and then they went out for a peer review. And we had 25% of our peer reviewers were Indigenous persons for the draft two. The International Arctic Science Committee ran that process for us, and we thank them. This, at the same time, the chapters went out to the Sustainable Development Working Group, and different Arctic countries and permanent participants provided us with feedback there, too, which was then incorporated into the draft three. And then the finalization of the chapters is just terminating as we speak, hopefully. So the report will be out late this fall. People have asked me exactly when. I can't tell you. There's been some slippage, but it has to be out in 2014 because it's a decadal reprise. And it's being published by the Nordic Council of Ministers, or Norden. And then coming from it will be a key findings document, which will provide the roadmap or the, I guess, the Coles notes to the roadmap for the Sustainable Development Working Group. And that's will be actually, those will be presented at the October meeting of the SAOs that's coming up, and then moving on from there. The report will probably, as far as I know, be launched at the ministerial, but I'm not quite sure about that. So that's my overview, and then we'll be hearing from about four chapters, and I'm looking forward to the reflection and the from Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell. So thank you.
The next speaker is Peter Schweitzer from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. He's speaking on cultures and identities in the North.
So as Gail already mentioned, I'm one from the old guard, so one who already participated in the first Arctic Human Development Report. I had Yvonne Chonka back then as my co-lead author for a chapter called Cultures and Societies. This time around, we have been three lead authors. Actually, we're one of the few chapters that has an Indigenous author. Olga Ulturgasheva, originally from Russia, is Evene herself and lives now in the UK. So we are, unfortunately, Yvonne Chonka was no longer able to participate with a new team that represents a kind of has a good geographic spread. So Peter Skjold being based in Scandinavia. We have two contributing authors, which is more than zero, but definitely less than 12. But it was already kind of for us a new experience just having three very involved authors, so we didn't feel the need so much for lots of contributors. I will talk about some of the differences. Instead of kind of explaining in many words what culture is just this little kind of collage of images, you know. This is what you often refer to as high culture, you know, the arts, or in this particular case, a new house of culture, so to say, in in Reykjavik Harpa that was just a couple of years ago opened, to subsistence activities like here reindeer herding that are extremely important for culture and identity in the Circumpolar North. These are kind of sacred sites here in the Russian North. You see sports, you see music, etc. So we have a very broad understanding of what culture and cultures are, and they are foundations for identities. And instead of showing lots of pictures, we threw on a number of different labels, because a big part of identities are the labels that come with them. And you know, just using the English language here, there's a lot of different identity labels that are being used in the North, native, non-native here in the Alaskan context, and that this indigenous, non-indigenous division permeates a lot of the distinctions in the North. But there are also mixed identities, like Métis, for example, being used in the Canadian North. But there are also other divisions that point to subsistence difference, like the reindeer herding Sami and the non-reindeer herding Sami in Sweden, which makes a huge difference there in terms of identity and rights that come with it. Also the so-called settler population, so all the folks that are non-indigenous, is not a homogeneous group and is often with different terminologies distinguished. The old settlers sometimes versus the newcomers. We start our chapter with an overview over colonial histories, or kind of a historical background, historical introduction to our topic, which we consider necessary. And again, this is just this represents four different areas of the North, from Yermak's campaign, so the Cossack commander in the 16th century who led a small troop of Cossacks across the Ural Mountains for the first time, which started the conquest of Siberia, to the news about the signing of Anxa here from the Tundra Times, which of course is an important without understanding Anxa we cannot understand contemporary cultures and identities, we have the air base in Greenland. All that it has done and all the protests that it has also fueled, clearly, relocations that it triggered, et cetera, or the so-called DISC system among the Inuit of Canada. So very different aspects of the historical record that continue to be important today. If you talk about culture and cultures, there you can focus on a variety of different aspects of culture. We decided to focus on three main areas, and one of them is languages and language vitality. And as Gail already pointed out, that in a way it goes back not only to the first Arctic Human Development Report, but also to the Arctic Social Indicators reports, which repeatedly, which took up the message from the first Arctic Human Development Report that cultural vitality is critical. And at the same time, ASI then developed the notion that linguistic vitality, language retention, language vitality, is a critical indicator for cultural vitality. This is just a snapshot to show you it's not just the development of the last 10 years, but basically for a period of more than 15 years in the Arctic. And the details are here not important. What is important? Basically, what is above the zero line are those individual languages that gained speakers in these years under considerations, and those on the right-hand side below the zero line, they lost speakers, they lost in the percentage of speakers. So this, for me, sums up the linguistic situation in the North. By and large, there is a decline of linguistic vitality, but there are some success stories. And it is really important to look at them closely, to learn lessons from them. Often it has to do not surprisingly, with the means. So often these success stories are in areas where there are more affluent indigenous communities that are able to invest money into that. But it's not money alone. It's the will of the people themselves to engage in learning and relearning the language. By the way, as you will be seeing in this chapter, overall the chapters in the Arctic Human Development Report are supposed to deal with all the residents of the Arctic, and we tried that very much as well in our chapter. But not surprisingly, when you talk about cultures and identities, there is a certain emphasis on indigenous languages or cultures and identities. And another aspect of cultures, Arctic cultures, for us is spiritualities and worldviews. I'm going to skip that now because we also want to hear about other chapters. It's just as is the issue on arts and sports. And for me, this is a particularly kind of vibrant area. You have the whole range from very traditional arts and sports activities represented in the World Eskimo Indian Olympics, to a Sami rock band here, and very contemporary Alaskan native art. In this area, you see a lot of movement, a lot of dynamic, a lot of vitality, and I think that is positive. You also see an increase of the social value and the cultural value of these productions, something that you didn't see 20, 30 years ago. Talking about sports, and Doug already mentioned, I'm a fan of soccer. This is the small but successful Faroese soccer team, which by the way beat the national team of Austria. Rudy knows about that. And for the small North Atlantic nation of the Faroes, soccer is one of the symbols of identity, which brings me to the other part of our chapter of identities. There are national identities, especially in areas such as the Faroes and Iceland, you have rather homogeneous national identities. In other parts of the North, it's more complex because there's often within in one country you have the contradistinction between the Southerners and the Northerners. More typically, on a very general scale, you have indigenous and settler population, but always, in reality, every country has a growing population of mixed people, biologically, culturally mixed, and that is that I think is one of the really interesting developments in the North. In some areas, it's acknowledged; in other parts of the North, it's not so much acknowledged because politics, identity politics, is more on this duality between indigenous and non-indigenous, but realities along that way. I'm not going to kind of go into, by the way, is anyone keeping time? How many minutes could you, five? Okay, great. Then what I wanted to say here is that it's probably not really part of a chapter on culture, but it became very important for us in writing to point out the difficulties. If you want to write about cultures and identities, you need numbers. You need numbers in terms of who declares himself, herself as belonging to which identity or belonging to which religious denomination. There are enormous issues with the statistics, so to say, of identity, which of course other chapters, such as the demography chapter, also point to. This point, second to the last, is this notion of in the past, being in the Arctic meant that you were far away, not only geographically far away, but you were socially far away. You were marginalized. You see that more and more, definitely in the European Arctic. Being northern is becoming you it becoming you getting more and more strategic advantage. I think you also see it in places like Alaska. You know, the not only the growing awareness about the North, but the kind of the cultural and social prestige that comes along with it. What I really want to focus on now are the major developments of the last of the last 10 years. Gary, in his presentation just an hour or two ago, brought in the distinction between slow and fast moving variables in social ecological systems. Culture, you could say, there are many aspects of culture, I would say, are slow moving variables. So in a way, on some level, you could say there hasn't been a lot of change in the 10 years. So a number of trends that we already saw in 2004 have continued. So these two parallel and somewhat contradictory trends of increasing revitalization of primarily indigenous cultures and languages, and on the other hand, globalization, cultural globalization, that seems to be the opposite of that. In a way, these two things do not contradict each other. They are parallel processes, and we need to take note of that. Our chapter, like some of the other chapters in the report, repeatedly point out that fate control, so meaning having control on the local level about, you know, about language politics, for example, because that's such a central aspect of our chapter here, is critical. And this, you know, if you look at the case studies where things have been going well, fate control, local control is a critical aspect. So about the similarities and differences between the North, I would say, you know, of course there are large similarities, but the major difference being that I think the North has a kind of the role of an avant-garde, as indigenous identity politics is concerned, and also bringing up the value of culture. So kind of using culture as a tool, as a weapon in a globalizing world. And this is now the final slide where I have already mentioned a number of the things. Climate change, as Gail mentioned, all of the chapters were asked to address that. We can only say it is important in some areas, but let's not jump to a conclusion that climate change is important for cultures and identities everywhere in the North. There's a lot of variation from locality to locality in terms of what the people themselves say about the importance of climate change. And it would be a mistake to assume that climate change is the major threat to cultures and identities. We have mentioned that several times, that the growing global awareness has its benefits and challenges for the people who live in the Arctic, but culture is becoming that resource. It's not only oil and other non-renewable resources that are attractive, but I think more and more northern culture is becoming an asset that is being sought after by southern consumers. Thank you very much.
The next speaker is Lee Husky of the University of Alaska Anchorage, who's speaking on economies of the North.
First of all, before I start, I want to apologize to Joan, who's not here, and Gail, who is here, and Mara, who got roped into
this late. I was that whiny, spoiled kid who kept saying I didn't want to do it and meet the time, deadlines and stuff. So, you know, it feels better being done, so I apologize. The other thing about doing these chapters, as a social scientist, something you think you understand, think you know, when you're asked to do this kind of survey, for me at least, it led me to know exactly how much I wish I knew and not necessarily knew. This is a chapter I did with Ilmo Manpa and Alexander Pilyasov. Alexander is from Russia, Ilmo's from Finland. I call this a helicopter and numbers driven view of the first decade of the 21st century. We used Ilmo's estimates of gross regional product. If any of you are familiar with the work of Econor, Ilmo's, this is a method that he's perfected over a couple of years of that report. And so we just used that and we tried to look at the whole of the Arctic. And what this means is the economy of the North is real diverse. And we rode roughshod over that diversity. The first decade of the 21st century is a period of relatively rapid growth in the monetary or the international or the modern economy, if you will, of the circumpolar North. But really, even though the rate of change was pretty dramatically different than it was when the first human development report was done, the economy hasn't changed much since that period of time. The surprising stuff about the Arctic economy is always when you take the Arctic as a region or the circumpolar North as a region, surprising thing, it's pretty big. Measured in terms of gross regional product, it's as big as countries. And during this period of time, one of the things that we found was the Arctic economy grew faster than the economies of the nations that contain the Arctic. And that was okay. What I wanted to do is just do is a quick overview of three things we were asked to do. What were the trends during that period of time? What did looking at this period of time tell us about what we expect to happen in the future? And then what are some myths, some holes, or some questions that we have, some research questions that we have about the economy? One of the things that's true is in the first decade of the 21st century, the Arctic economy as a whole grew pretty dramatically, but that growth and that economic activity was concentrated. It was concentrated primarily in the Russian North and in Alaska. And even within each Arctic country, production was concentrated. So one of the lessons about the economy of the North is it was this was a decade of much growth, but the growth wasn't evenly spread throughout the countries of the Arctic or the Arctic regions of those countries. Two things that resulted in concentration are obvious things. One was the existence of resources. They're not evenly spread, so economic activity wasn't evenly spread. And then the existence of cities. And that's the thing that I think is interesting for the future. I think somebody mentioned that today. What role settlements will play in the future of the northern economy. One of the things that we worry a lot about when we talk about the economy of any region is how much of the rent or the production of the region stays in the region. So you can have a lot of production in Alaska. We always look at Kennecott, the Kennecott mine. There are a lot of production, but nothing stayed in Alaska. Everything left. So that's one of the questions when we look at the Arctic. How much of this production stayed in the Arctic? Because there's lots of institutional reasons for that. For production, the rents that are generated by resource production to leave the region. Capital comes from outside, lots of labor comes from outside, national governments take rent away and taxes. And so we're interested in how does this growth in economic activity that took place in the first decade, how did that affect the people of the region? One measure of that, just a rough measure of whether this activity had any real positive effect on the population of the of the region is, does it look like people in the region got jobs from this economic activity? And one of the things we found that except for the Russian North, both population and employment growth grew, and the dependency rate increased only in Greenland and Iceland. So outside of Russia, all the other northern places, the dependency rate fell. The dependency rate is the number of people per job. And so if that rate's falling, it's at least possible that more people in the region are actually being employed. Of course, in the north, when we look at why the growth occurred, what we focus on is the importance of two sectors. That's the resource production, which was big, and the public sector. We know this from our long history of looking at the economy of the North, the two important sectors, the production of natural resources and the government sector. And those, of course, were important throughout the North. As this says here, those two sectors made up half of production in six of the eight Arctic nations. But even in terms of what was produced in these regions, there was real diversity there. And there's this kind of cool, interesting difference between the way the Nordic North, the European North, and the rest fell out. The Nordic North is less dependent on natural resource production and government. Okay, more different kinds of activities outside of those areas were important for those sectors of the North. I think you can summarize sort of what we found about the North by looking at what we concluded were some trends that we thought will take the North into the future, things to keep in mind. The Arctic, we believed, the Arctic is a high-cost region, and we don't see that changing. Now, let me just put this in a little context. I've lived in Alaska a long time. And one of the things you learn about when you live in the North is the hopeful language people use to talk about the economy. You know, it's the boom is always on the horizon. And in the North, across the circumpolar North now, this is the language of economics. It's this hopeful language. And it comes from, in this first decade of the 21st century, the story is often built around climate change. We can all say it. It's a mantra, right? Climate change is making excess to resources in the North. This storehouse of resources we've always known is there. It's making those resources accessible. And so it's opening up the North. It's climate change that's opening up the North. And in a sense, that's implies in the future, resource production will continue because the climate change will make it cheaper to produce in the North. Well, maybe some places, but probably not everywhere and probably not much of the region. I think climate change on the North Slope, we know that increases the cost of production. It reduces the time that international energy companies have to spend on the land, okay, which increases their cost of development and exploration. So there are positive and negative effects of climate change. And so I think in the long run, we still have to worry about the Arctic as a high-cost region. Second trend that will affect the continued economic activity in the North is that this was something that was pointed out in the first AHDR. There's been an institutional change in the North. More and more resource production decisions are profit-driven. Okay, there's a change. They're not strategy-driven so much anymore. They're profit-driven. And as we go forward, economic development in the North will be driven by profits. And one of the things that we have to remind ourselves of when we look at this first decade of the 21st century and the rapid increase in economic activity, this was a time of high resource prices. Okay, and part of the hopeful dialogue about the future is, of course, those high prices will continue forever. As an economist, I wouldn't make that bet. Resource prices have gone up and come back down historically. And so as resource prices return to Earth, that has an effect on economic activity. I think we saw that in many resource projects throughout the North that have are put on hold or have been shut down as prices fell at the end of the first decade of the 21st century. I think when we look at the future, one of the things that we found in the past, I think this isn't going to change. It's a concentration of economic activity. Concentration comes in the North for a lot of reasons. It comes because resources are concentrated, but it also comes because people like to produce where they've already produced. And, you know, like is, it's late, I'm sorry. Like is not a technical term, is it? They like to produce where they've already produced because it's often cheaper there. The resources are there, the infrastructure is there. And so we would expect to see concentration, continued concentration in northern resource production. I think in the future, and this number four here is, I think, where we, Nikolai talked about hope in the darkest times. This is, number four is where we hang our hope for the future in the economy of the North, and that's the increased privatization and localization of decision making. And by that, I mean, you know, one of the great trends throughout the North is increased ownership and decision-making authority of people who live in the North, whether that's Alaska Native, Alaska Regional Corporations, whether that's land claims organizations in Canada, whether it's the government of Finnmark or Greenland or the North Slope Borough. We're seeing this increased tendency for people in the North to make decisions about resource use. Natural resource production. And then throughout the future, we can't forget, and this the chapter suggests the importance of these other sectors other than natural resource production for the market. And that's the traditional sector and the public and this non-resource sector. Three areas that we mentioned as places where we wish we had more knowledge are where we thought the opportunities for more for research to learn something was available was first of all in this area of innovations in local decision-making organizations. Let me explain this. Here's the link. We have these organizations, native claims, land claims, governments, that are more involved in making decisions about the use of local resources and claiming more of the rents from those production for local residents. We have, throughout the North, we've had this great natural experiment. There's all sorts of these kinds of organizations that make decisions differently, that share resources differently throughout the whole North. We have an opportunity to look across the North at this variety of ownership regimes, well, maybe ownerships in quotes regimes, and see what works and what doesn't work and how we can improve them. That's a gap in our knowledge that we could fill. Another thing that shows up is throughout the North, there are these non-natural resource, non-public sector activities that are taking place, whether it's finance, if you're anybody from Iceland might chuckle about this, but the whole financial experiment in Iceland didn't seem like a northern thing, but it was a northern thing, okay? And it took place in the North. The whole technology revolution that took place in Oulu, that's not a northern thing, it took place in the North. The growth of tourism, okay? So there's this that's where I was going with this, sorry about that. This stuff takes place in cities. And so one of the things that when we look to the future, we need to ask ourselves is how does cities change the economy of the North? And then last, one of the things that we've mentioned in the chapter is the continued importance of the traditional economy throughout the North, and it's an economy that we don't know much about, or at least we're not able to easily compare it to the modern or the are the international economy, because we can't measure it in terms of dollars. That may not even be the way you should do it. But we need to have a better understanding of which will allow us to compare the traditional and the modern sectors. Thanks.
You're listening to a preview of the forthcoming 2014 Arctic Human Development Report on Addressing Alaskans. Scientists present their work in the areas of culture and identity, economies of the North, and resource governance. This talk was recorded September 19th at the UAA APU Consortium Library. The next speaker is UAF's Gary Kofinas, who talks on resource governance.
As was mentioned, our chapter is on resource governance. I am the co-lead author with Bruce Forbes. Bruce is a research professor at the Arctic Center at University of Lapland in Rovaniemi. We structured our chapter somewhat differently than the ones that have been described by having 9 different contributing authors. And I'll talk a little bit about how we engaged them in that process. The way we started the process was, of course, to go back and read the Arctic Human Development Report number 1, and that chapter was led by Rick Caulfield. It was quite striking to think about the issues that they were describing in that chapter and the kind of things we talk about today. And that was our point of departure. And that the first Arctic Human Development Report talked a lot about property rights. It talked a lot about the need for co-management. It gave a number of examples of how those were playing out, and issues of property rights and performance of power sharing between local communities and in management of commonly shared natural resources. As we looked ahead, we realized that one of the big issues in resource governance now has to do with this issue of the Arctic and Arctic resource governance being thrust into the global context. It's no longer a regional and somewhat esoteric event. And I've got the picture of the Russian flag being planted, being claiming non-renewable resource under the sea there. This global context has implications to climate change, as well as we think about how a climate regime shift could have implications for the global climate as well. We also realized that resource of non-renewable resource extraction had become much more of an issue, a challenge in resource governance than it had been back then. The demand for non-renewable resources in the North is greater than it ever has been. The discussion on property rights is still important, and that's mentioned in the chapter in a number of ways. While it's interesting to hear about the economic chapter seeing greater devolution of decision-making in the economic sector, I can't say that we've seen a significant increase in property rights over management of natural resources. There have been some major events that have occurred, but pretty much it's been the same. But what we've seen is a real opportunity to look and see how are those systems of governance working where there's strong community participation or multi-stakeholder involvement, and to really ask the question, given that the North faces all these rapid, significant changes that are occurring and interacting drivers of change like development plus climate change, to what extent are those co-management regimes going to facilitate social learning and be adaptive co-management systems? And how well will all these resource management programs and systems respond to climate change? We also noted that the integration of knowledge is it's no longer a debate about whether or not we should see local and traditional knowledge as legitimate. Now the question is, how do we bring that together with this other system of knowledge? How do we integrate this and have a more holistic understanding? So those are just some of the starting points that we outline in the chapter. And the way we approached it is we described those in general terms, and we had case studies, which I will just describe very briefly. Is Shanda here? Shanda was the lead author on this, and she was with us today, really talking about informal arrangements between, and Vera Metcalf was with us all today. She was a co-author as well on this one. Informal relationships, community to community relationships across Alaska and Russia in management of walrus, and how a lot of work was being done to coordinate activities, to think about monitoring, to develop science agendas that didn't involve formal agreements. And it was a really terrific case study that talked about the Bering Strait and what was happening in this international arrangement. There was a case study on Nordic reindeer governance in the context of contemporary protected areas. This really focused quite a bit on Sweden and how there, while there were some property rights that afforded reindeer herders special use, that was often independent of land use planning activity. So there was a real disconnect and increasing pressure, which in some ways eroded the Sami people's rights, and a whole number of issues having to do with predators and charismatic megafauna and how that was being dealt with. Contrasting to that was a case study about Sami fishing rights and indigenous participation in Norwegian fisheries governance, where Sami fishing rights really had found a place within a multi-stakeholder setting and had been quite successful in meeting Sami needs. So it wasn't as if it was an exclusive right. It had been incorporated into a greater system and had seemed to be working pretty well with some warts and blemishes. Bruce Forbes developed a case study on indigenous industrial relations in the tundra zone of Russia's Tima, Pokhara and Western Siberian basins. This is basically the Yamal and an area close to the Yamal where there is seasonal movements of reindeer herds and actually a fairly resilient cultural system in this area. And his discussion has a lot to do with industry developing best practices and how they were going to do the work, and because of those best practices and the interactions with industry in those areas, that indigenous reindeer herders were able to adapt. And there was a contrast between two areas showing how it worked really well in some areas, better than others. And so there was a number of problems that are, and a number of questions. Reindeer herders depend a lot on fisheries, and fisheries are often an issue in the lakes of that area, but there seemed to be some success stories in resource governance in the Soviet Union, which is somewhat anomalous. There's not a lot of success when we went through resource governance issues, people would often say, except for Russia. We had a really interesting discussion about Greenland assuming responsibilities for extraction of and governance of non-renewable resources, and an effort to create a system of public participation where there was no history of that. There's the history of colonialism and Danish rule, and how there was this kind of clunky process of engaging the community, the citizens of that that country in decision making, and how it had its share of problems. There was a case study about the transformation and restructuring of forestry with some examples of Sweden, some of the issues around trying to maintain and develop sustainable forestry practices. And finally, Oren Young and Paula Kopala gave us a case study on the role of the Arctic Council in resource governance really highlighting how the authority of the powers of the Arctic of the Arctic Council are really limited. It's a recommending body. It facilitates. It doesn't make a lot of decisions. But in spite of that, they pointed out that there had been a number of successes contributing to resource governance in the North. And so that's those are the case studies. They're quick reads, and they're quite informative. And so across the board, we saw some trends, and one of them had to do with the complexity, an increasing complexity of resource governance, the number of players, the number of rules, the regimes. In some cases, that's a good thing if we think about this idea of polycentricity and how overlapping systems can create redundancy and really help a system be more resilient, but it also can create more conflict. There was greater acknowledgement of the cognitive rather than physical human land relations, and by that, there seems to be a greater acknowledgement in all of these case studies about how people relate to the land, and human environment relationships were described in many of the case studies as being really critical. How we see the land and how we see nature seems to be a very important part, and it's been highlighted as critical among indigenous peoples of the North. And also is an increasing adoption of best practices. So we're left with a few questions. Can the existing systems of resource governance keep pace with rapid change? It's a really big question. Are the institutions able to evolve, to be flexible enough and responsive enough given the kind of changes that are likely to occur in the future? And what are the effects of all this need for responsiveness and greater demands on community involvement, where there's already limited funding, and there might be even that may be more stress in the future, and also environmental monitoring programs that are often underfunded, and how will that play out with limited funding? And finally, to what extent, this is where I started, to what extent the resource governance systems can facilitate social learning and innovation. So with that, it's all yours. Thank you.
The next speakers are Diane Hirschberg, who is speaking on education in the North, followed by Andre Petrov, who will be speaking on human capital.
Hi, I'm Diane Hirschberg from University of Alaska, Anchorage, and Andre Petrov from University of Northern Iowa will speak after me. And you'll see at the end of this, we do have a list of our contributing authors, and we really have quite a few, in part because at least for me, one of the interesting things is the lack of a broad array of literature on Arctic education in English. And so instead of trying to figure this out myself, I actually went to the source and brought in a lot of authors from other nations, in particular indigenous authors, who helped frame a lot of the information that we ended up including in this chapter. And Gail gave a bit of an overview of what we've added, especially in terms of human capital. But we also did add a discussion about the importance of indigenous as well as Western epistemologies and ways of teaching and learning. And a brief discussion about informal processes for transferring knowledge, that education is not necessarily what we tend to think about with formal schooling. That it's much broader than that. Also looking at a shift in a conversation about the purpose of both formal and informal education that's not just about workforce or further education, but also success in retaining cultures or being productive members of communities. And we really did, again, have a big emphasis on human capital development as part of this conversation on education. And so I'm gonna talk mostly about the K-12 education findings, and then Andre will talk about the post-secondary and human capital. And what's very consistent across the North, unfortunately, is some of the less positive news. And a lot of things that are very familiar to people in Alaska. First of all, Other chapters talk about population migration and the fact that we have a lot of small rural communities that continue to decrease in size, and what goes along with that is schools closing. A lot of northern areas, especially the most small, the most remote communities, schools are closing, and when schools close, often communities are threatened. We've had 27 schools in Alaska close since 1998 due to declining numbers, and as of this past year, it looked like we were going to have more close, and there is an ongoing discussion about whether we can maintain the
Now, Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell takes the floor to offer reflections and further discussion on some of the work presented this evening on the forthcoming 2014 Arctic Human Development Report. Treadwell is the former chair of the U.S. Arctic Resource Commission and Alaska's current Lieutenant Governor.
Teachers. Those of you, again, in Anchorage would have seen in Sunday's paper a long article about this issue and the difficulties both in attracting teachers from outside because we're not preparing enough of our own local teachers from our rural and remote communities, and then the issue of keeping teachers once we get them here. Again, this is consistent whether you're looking across northern Canada or many other parts in northern Arctic Europe and in Russia. There's a lot of issues. We're talking about cultures and identities of non-indigenous, non-rural, urban people coming into our rural and remote communities and not succeeding, not so much because they are not good teachers, but because they're not prepared to be interacting with the cultures in those communities or to deal with the living conditions, which are quite different. And you saw referenced earlier that there is this interesting dual happening with languages, that there's both an increasing there's an increase in the attention to the need to preserve indigenous languages. Language revitalization is a big push. We've got language immersion schools. You've got Sami language schools. And yet, at the same time, we've got language loss. And what part of that is, it has to do with also who we get in as educators. So if you can't find educators who can actually teach in heritage languages, and also because a lot of families continue to want their students to learn in a Western language so that they can compete in the economy, we end up having ongoing problems with language loss. And then we have an achievement gap that is particularly problematic for Indigenous students. And you see some of the data here that in Nunavut, graduation rates are between 32% and 38%. In a four-year period. I heard some reference yesterday to there being great successes in Nunavut by an educator in this state who came out of Canada, and I thought, I don't know where she's getting her data, but what we're hearing is there's still, though there's been progress, a lot of difficulty. Nunavik, slightly to the east there, fewer than one out of five students getting the equivalent of a high school diploma. And looking at the difference continuing between dropout rates for Indigenous and non-Indigenous students and graduation rates, where the graduation rate for Indigenous students in 2013 was 57% versus 70, almost 72% for all students. And once you separate this out for some of our more rural and remote communities, the data gets even more stark. At the same time, we have across the North communities that are moving toward creating educational models that are incorporating or based on traditional ways of teaching and learning. It's not just acknowledging cultures. We had a conversation this morning about, you know, ministries of culture looking at Indigenous people simply in terms of dance or arts. And now there's many places a deeper understanding of very different approaches to pedagogy. In Greenland, you have a system that has been struggling with the legacy of colonization and a Danish model of teaching and an intentional conversation and approach to a decolonized model of teaching, especially trying to help teachers understand the system they came through and how they can do things differently. We've got the North Slope Borough School District, which has developed the NUPIAC learning framework and is now going through a very extensive curriculum development process that both uses Alaska's content standards, which have been really enhanced and strengthened, but also uses the NUPIAC learning framework with the notion that you can teach children from within their culture and using indigenous ways of teaching and learning and still have them excel and be able to compete in the Western economic and educational system. So in some places, these efforts are government driven. In other places, these efforts are happening despite the government. The gender gap, we talked about gender issues, and this continues, and in a lot of cases, people don't realize, but maybe in this room we do, that the gender gap often means that women are leaving men behind, in particular in education. And again, if you look at Nunavut, women graduated high school at a higher rate than men in all but 1 year. The high school graduation rates were relatively low, but you were seeing much higher rates for women than men. And again, in Alaska, the gap is considerable, in particular when you look at indigenous or African American men and women in our state. Andre.
Okay, well, so the other part of this chapter is about human capital, and it's kind of new. Well, I guess it is a new component in the Arctic Human Development Report, and so I'll allow myself to have a few slides. So we devoted a little bit of time to explain why human capital should be a part of Human Development Report and how human development is framed by human capital, right? So of course we know that human capital in general is a major driver of modern economy, and it has a special role in the Arctic. And I think it's part of the argument of this new report that human investment in human capital, investment in people, is something that actually probably one of the ways to break away from resource dependency and allow growth and real development from within Arctic communities. So that's one of the kind of new arguments that we introduced. We looked at human capital and its traditional understanding as capacities and knowledge through the formal education, but also we looked at other elements of human capital, such as creative capital, ability to innovate, create new things, whether they come from entrepreneurial component, they come from technical innovation, they come from culture. So that's the idea. And we argue that the role of education in economic well-being or other components of well-being, and again, education broadly defined, is very definitive in this 21st century, in this second report of the 21st century. So human capital, we define the stock of knowledge and skills embodied in human population that have economic value. That's very important. So this is deployable knowledge, knowledge that people utilize for economic benefit for themselves or their community, right? They could be subdivided in general skills, specific skills, and technical and scientific knowledge. And most of what we were analyzing is the higher levels of education, which is post-secondary education. There are certain things that I would like to highlight. First of all, increase of access to post-secondary education across the Arctic is quite substantial. Even in the last 10 years, we see that every major country, I guess every country except Canada in the Arctic has a university. Well, Canada, of course, has only Yukon College, Aurora College, and of course, other educational institutions that are not universities, but maybe soon. But still, we have growth and availability of education and investment in certain programs. And of course, in Alaska, we see as well, growing educational institutions. if you look at this map very briefly, we see that that's the enrollment and in educational institutions around Arctic and subarctic that we had data for. And as you see, of course, there's a lot of institutions in Scandinavian North and in Russia, and of course in Alaska, and I guess some institutions in the Canadian North as well. Of course, the University of Greenland and Iceland are quite substantial as well. Another component that we looked at is educational attainment. And educational attainment is a variable that is the most sort of straightforward and easy to collect, right? Because basically we look at people that achieved certain level of education. In this case, it's post-secondary education, so they have bachelor's degree or higher. And we see that, so the map on the left is the bachelor, the map on the right is a master's degree and up. We see that, you know, there is substantial variability. Russian North is looking pretty well. Scandinavian North is looking pretty well. However, of course, in the master's degrees, we see and that Canadian Alaska is doing okay. I mean, again, this is in comparison to other regions, right? When we compare with educational attainment in lower 48 or the southern Canada, that looks slightly different. However, still there are good news there as well. Let me show you here. We try to look at this from the standpoint of so-called talent index. So it doesn't mean we don't need to know much about it. But this one, in addition to what I just showed, also demonstrates comparison between the region in the Arctic and its metropolis, a southern sort of region, right? So that's a slightly different picture. So we see that that in Alaska regions, right, we have, of course, Anchorage, Fairbanks coming out pretty strongly, but of course the other regions are, Juneau, right? It's the three urban, so more urban boroughs are doing pretty well, but the rest is not very well. While in Russia, for example, we have fairly high educational attainment compared to the rest of Russia, and that's of course related to those workers who come there for oil, gas, and other industries. But still, I think the argument that we make is that Arctic has human capital. I mean, there is human capital in the Arctic. The big question is how we could deploy it to work locally, not fly in, fly out, not take, you know, take this influx of human capital in and then immediately out. But how do we make sure that we have the human capital that is in the Arctic, stays in the Arctic, and works for the Arctic, I think. Map on the right, by the way, looking at the cities. And of course, cities are the major bearers of human capital. And you see there's quite a few cities in a darker brown that have very high levels of human capital, right? And of course, we see some in the in Alaska, Anchorage, and Juneau especially. And in Russian North, of course, the cities of the rapidly developing West Siberia. So what are the major findings that we can report today? First of all, it's an increasing role of human capital and demand for human capital for economic well-being, fate control, and human development in general. That's very important. So the role of human capital is increasing and will be increasing because we live in an economy in which this is the major asset. At the same time, there are persistent gaps in human capital that related to gaps in education. Gap between Arctic and the southern regions, we still see that. Gap between urban and industrial Arctic regions and the rest of the Arctic. That's a quite stark difference between urban Arctic and non-urban Arctic. And we still see the gap between indigenous and non-indigenous population in terms of the formal schooling, right? And there are quite a telling numbers here from different regions. We were collecting this data from various parts of the Arctic. Persistent high school dropout rates, and Diane mentioned it, which propagates further, right? And so if you drop out of high school, you won't attain other levels of education, at least formal education. And that's, of course, one of the biggest problems. Another problem is a brain drain, right? The brain drain, whether it's before you attain the education or when you attain education, but also brain turnover, the one that I referred already, that people with education come to the North, but then they don't stay, they go away. So their brains are not invested locally, and that's exactly one of the biggest problems. And an interesting notion of brain waves, when people, you know, there is a large surge of educated people, and then they all leave when resource, for example, economy is going down. Still, we observe the gains in post-secondary education and both among indigenous people and among the rest of the Arctic population, which is a positive result, of course. Another interesting trend that has been observed before, but we confirm it and emphasize, it's a feminization of human capital. Women dominate the realm of education. Whether we're looking at enrollments in most Arctic universities or looking at educated people with bachelor's degree and up, the women are dominating, right? And that's, of course, very important. Another component that we also mentioned, and Diane referred to it already, that we have an improving relationship with between formal and local indigenous knowledge and education, because we have this growing realization that both of them are important for building human capital in the Arctic. Both of these need to be integrated, right? And that's very promising as well. And that's a fairly new trend. So these are the list of our co-authors. And that is really what I think the most exciting part about this chapter, right? That it's not just Diane and I sit down in the office and type it up, but this is really a work of a lot of people. And I think it's interesting chapter because of that, and because it also, as I said, bring new things that HDR1 did not do. So with that, I guess I rest my case.
Now, Lieutenant Governor Mead Treadwell takes the floor to offer reflections and further discussion on some of the work presented this evening on the forthcoming 2014 Arctic Human Development Report. Treadwell is the former chair of the U.S. Arctic Resource Commission and Alaska's current Lieutenant Governor.
Well, I want to start out by saying I recognize you've been at this all day, and so is the guy between you and dinner, you and drinks. I'm not going to take very long, but I want to talk about two things. First off is what the significance of what you're doing here, both with FROST and with the AHDR that we just heard about, because I think it's so incredibly important. And the second is to just kind of give you a little bit of a historical view on some of the institutions we've created to address the challenges that we've talked about and some of the others that are being thought of. But first off, you know, if you think about what you're doing here, I can put it in several different contexts, literary, research contexts, even geopolitical context. Probably the first collaboration of authors that I was ever aware of, I was a young 13-year-old boy, and my mom would not let me read a book by Penelope Asch called Naked Came the Stranger. If anybody knows this book, it was written by 25 journalists who tried to write the sauciest, dirtiest novel they could write. And they did. It was a number of Pulitzer Prize winners, and they put together this book about a woman who found out that her husband was cheating, and so each chapter was another one of her affairs to get back at him. But I think they sold something like 400,000 copies, and then went public and said, no, this was not written by the woman, it was written by 25 journalists, which then meant they sold more copies. So as you write your collaborations, just set that standard aside. I don't know that you could ever get 400,000 copies, but think about that. One of the earliest collaborations that I started to use as I wanted to learn more about the Arctic was a 1978 book written by Terence Armstrong at Cambridge and George Rogers, who was an Alaskan who was the founder of the Institute of Social and Economic Research here, and a Canadian explorer and Graham Rowley, called the Circumpolar North. And for many years, as I went across the Soviet Union in 1981 and was trying to think about the Arctic as a cohesive economic place, that was one of the first collaborations. And that did not sell 400,000 copies, and I couldn't find anything saucy in it, and my mother had no problem with me reading it. Nor did my grandmother, whom I actually gave a copy to. And of course, you stand on the shoulders, and you stand in the tradition of others who have tried to assess the human condition in a more cohesive way. And I would say on my bookshelf, I love to pull down Knud Rasmussen's report of the Fifth Thule Expedition in the 30s and Peter Friken's Book of the Eskimo in 1961, which brings this together. So you are definitely following a very important tradition of collaboration of looking at the Arctic, and I think you're this is the mainstream right here, and that's what's very exciting. Another thing that's very important that I see, and I'm sorry Vera's not here now, because I consider one of my best teachers in the Arctic today, Vera Metcalf, who you had with you today. And not only did I have the honor of serving with her on the Arctic Research Commission, as we put social science for the first time in the U.S. research goals. It's something I'm very proud that Vera and I and the other commissioners were able to do, but also brought much more attention to the protection of indigenous languages, and that's significant. And I found that what Vera taught me, I am constantly having to teach other politicians and leaders about co-management. And I'm not going to name the governor who looked at me quizzically by saying, what does that mean? But the fact is that as we talked about this, as we talked about this in the resource governance section of this report, it is truly amazing how in some parts of our discussions, the question of local knowledge is one that gets balled up in legal battles. We had it in our battle over coastal zone management and so forth. We can actually see very, very concrete, better management of whales because of co-management, better management of polar bears, better management of walrus, actually more successful populations, more successful use. A fascinating and curious situation happening in Southeast Alaska right now where while the state of Alaska and the national government have huge battles on predator control, you'll find state fishermen who are trying to preserve our shell fisheries in Southeast Alaska very, very reliant on co-managers of sea otters, where it's because of the local co-management part with the federal government, we have leverage in order to help preserve our shell fisheries. And so that's something else that Vera taught me. So I just wanted to give a shout out to Vera as someone who actually helped the United States spend much more time thinking about social science and also helping us all understand the importance of co-management. Another figure I'd like to just kind of talk about as we move forward to what you're doing and why it's so important is probably the first Alaskan I ever had a chance to sit down and have dinner with, and his name was Ernest Greeney. And this was 40 years ago this spring. And I like to tell kids that Ernest Greening and I went to the same high school, though many years apart. And he had come back to visit our school the year I was a senior, which was the year he died. And he spoke about the Vietnam War, for which he was very famous because he had been one of the two senators casting a vote against the Gulf of Tonkin resolution. But at dinner, I sat across from him and I told him that I was going to Alaska that summer. And he said, how long are you going for? And I said, about 3 weeks. And he said, 3 weeks? And he shrieked, practically. I've been there 30 years and I still haven't had a chance to see everything I wanted to see, everything I wanted to do. And he convinced me to stay for the summer, and 40 years later is still where I am and very happy to be. But he wrote a book about his political career, and a lot of it was about the life of being a senator during the time of the Kennedy administration, being one of Alaska's first senators, being a senator at the time of the Great Society. And there's a lot I probably didn't agree with him on, but the most fascinating thing I found is that here he was, one of Alaska's first U.S. senators. And he decided to make a pest of himself every time there was a hearing about foreign aid to some country from the United States to the poorer parts of the world. And essentially, he would go into the hearing as an Alaskan and ask for foreign aid for Alaskans. Because he basically said, if you look at the social and economic conditions of Alaska Natives especially, I don't know that the term third world country was popular then, but what he would say today is it was a third world country. And to the extent that you have a chance, read his book, Many Battles, because it talks about that. It followed another role that Greening had had in getting Alaska to become a state. And he gave a famous speech at our Constitutional Convention, which was titled, Let Us Now End American Colonialism. And it is still very popular around here. You hear Julie Kitka, the head of the Alaska Federation of Natives, say it. You used to hear a libertarian, more right-wing politician who's dead now named Joe Vogler read Article 73 of the UN Charter, which is a declaration regarding non-self-governing territories, where the founders of the United Nations in the Charter said that it is the members of the United Nations which have or assume responsibilities for the administration of territories whose peoples have not yet attained a full measure of self-government recognize the principle that the interests of the inhabitants of these territories are paramount and accepted as a sacred trust the obligation to promote to the utmost within the system of international peace and security established by the present charter the well-being of the inhabitants of these territories, and to this end, to ensure with due respect for the culture of the peoples concerned, their political, economic, social, and educational advancement, their just treatment, their protection against abuses, to develop self-government, to take due account of the political aspirations of the people and to assist them in the progressive development of their free political institutions. And it goes on. One of the things that's regularly pointed out is that nations agreed at that time to transmit regularly to the Secretary General for information purposes statistical and other information of a technical nature, basically saying how good a job are you doing on this. And many of the areas here, Greenland, Alaska, the Canadian territories, all were once part of those submissions of those countries to say, what are you doing for self-determination? And Greening talked about that whole process of ending colonialism in his speech to the Constitutional Convention in 1955. He's also well known around here, by the way, for passing, for working with a Native leader named Paratovich, a woman, to pass one of the first anti-discrimination laws in the United States. And I bring this up because the significance of what you're working on today, both with what we saw with the HDR and with what you're doing with Frost, is applying social science to actually advancing the cause of human welfare in the North. And you stand in a very positive and important tradition. And if we were to look at what we've accomplished since Ernest Greening died, or since Ernest Greening left the Senate, he left the Senate in 1968, the list is amazing, and it's been mentioned, many of them have been mentioned here significantly tonight. We talked about sports. Well, it was just in the late 60s that we founded the Arctic Winter Games, which is something that still is bringing people together and helping teach generations of kids here about their neighborhoods. And we just had a great Winter Games in Fairbanks. We had the Alaska Native Land Claim Settlement Act, which you saw the headline of Nixon signing it in 1971. And today, I don't think anybody realized that the corporations established under ANCSA would be the economic powerhouses that they are today. We had the Magnuson-Stevens Act in 1976, which threw out the foreign fishermen and essentially separated the Betsy's here. Betsy, you, as a student of international law, we had held up protecting our fisheries for a long time because we hadn't separated the economic rights from the freedom of navigation rights. And we finally came around as a country to do that, and our arguments on law of the sea were very important. Well, that has had a tremendous effect on the human welfare of residents of the Arctic in this part of the world. Not only with the 200-mile limit, which was established in 76, and the Americanization exercises, which happened in the 80s and the 90s, but also in the 90s, we established community development quotas. We're now 27,000 Alaskans who live onshore actually receive a large chunk of the income from the fisheries offshore, because we were able to do that. So that's one significant change, something to be aware of. We've already talked about co-management, but the Marine Mammal Protection Act in 1972, again, being something that is part of co-management and authorizing it is important. The Alaska Lands Act in 1980. Alaskans still have lots of challenges about the Alaska Lands Act, which set aside a large area of the state in wilderness and conservation units, but it did come up with a major recognition for subsistence rights, which continues to be a bit of a fight today, but a very important recognition. We talked about education, a Molly Hooch case in 1976, which actually built up rural schools, and we've had, I'm proud as Lieutenant Governor, we've been able to settle another case that has helped the renewal of schools. But in terms of addressing the challenge that was talked about here, you know, it's no longer save the whales, it's save the males, it sounds like. The challenge that is talked about here in terms of bringing higher education to Alaska, I just would commend you to look at a program called the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, which their annual dinner is usually sometime in January. And to see a hall filled with 1,000 people, the kids, the parents, the teachers, the companies that support it. One, you know, ANCSA is a bit of a driver, but as a result of ANCSA and the corporations, you have more and more kids taking, it's almost double the national average of kids who are finishing algebra, of kids who are taking the mathematical and the technical classes, as you talk about in human capital. And so that institution is one that we're very proud of. Tribal recognition in 1993, has made a difference. In some ways, it's added another locus in the villages that, you know, and you have competing civil governments and tribal governments, and there's some challenges there that are all part of the resource governance part of your report. But at the same time, what the tribes have done, have accomplished individually, and there's a couple of hundred of them, is nowhere near as much as what they've accomplished together. And the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium is one very good example. It's one case where self-determination in health has really happened here in the last 20 years in a significant way that we're very proud of. And we're seeing it not only in addressing health disparities, which are major and addressed in your report, but also in addressing the great disparity in sanitation and some other issues. I was proud to serve on their foundation, the Healthy Alaska Native Foundation. Another institution or set of institutions arose with the opening of the border at the end of the Cold War. And Vera, with her many hats, is also head of the Alaska-Siberia Commissioner, the Alaska-Russia Commission. I'm not sure I've got the name right. But in my job, victories come as small victories someday. And I got a note today from the head of the Interior Department here, very excited that an American citizen who was a Yupik carver in Russia, immigrated to the United States, carves here, had tackled me in Kotzebue and said that she was no longer allowed to carve in her native tradition. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife has now said she can, as of today. And the question is, who gets to call her with the news tomorrow? But the point being is that opening that border has been a very significant change that I believe has helped the welfare on both sides. And one of the most amazing impacts of opening that border has been the cooperation. It was mentioned in one of the papers about walrus, but I would say on whaling. Russia used to oppose U.S. quotas for indigenous whaling. And now we work together using common knowledge to go fetch a quota together. And that's a very exciting thing that has happened. We have an Alaska Native Language Commission, which was established about 3 years ago. We have an Alaska Suicide Commission, which is working to address a disparity problem here. And I would say that all of these institutions that we've worked to create in our part of the world have some mirror institution in other parts of the Arctic. And the question that I would have is, after your report, the one thing is, your report is in many ways a report card on these institutions. It's also a raison d'etre for many of these institutions. And it's important for us as policymakers to be able to mark our progress. And so I thank you. The one other thing I want to say about your report and its importance, and I'll say this for both the research question in FROST, especially question three, which is, what are the best ways of measuring achievements toward adaptation, thrivability, and sustainable development in the Arctic? And as you look at the measuring question in FROST, and as you look at the various ways that you've taken each of these aspects, I'd say it has a new set of consumers that you should be aware of. And again, it's not going to get you to Penelope Ash's sales, but the point that was made in the presentations about how the economy is growing here and how our Arctic economy is growing faster than the eight host nations is very significant. This region of the world is now looked at as one of the world's emerging markets. And the characteristics of an emerging market are areas that have significant growth, that have some engine for growth, which at this point is natural resources, but I would argue it's also transportation with the sea routes and aviation. I would hope that our current situation with Russia becomes a small bump in the road rather than a new barrier. But this part of the world does have that potential, and the institution of the Arctic Circle meeting that is coming up again in October, hosted by the President of Iceland and Alice Rogoff, or the institution of the global, where the Davos group, the World Economic Council, has got a group working on how to make this place investable, or the Arctic Council's new Arctic Economic Council, where I sent off the Alaska delegation last month, saying if there's one thing you can do is work with AHDR on getting statistics so that we can see how we build trade, build investment, build jobs, build human capital, reach our education goals. I think it's very, very important that you look at this report as something that's fundamental to success in the real sustainability of the Arctic economy in the years to come. Because if we don't look at those things, we're not going to have renewal of Prudhoe Bay or whatever. We're not going to have renewal of Red Dog here, which is a major driver in Northwest Alaska, or whatever. We're not going to convert the 8As who are graduating to be export of human capital and knowledge. We're not going to sustain native arts. We're not going to continue to pioneer, as I believe we have, in innovation in this part of the world with ways to export technology to other developing and rural parts of the world, as we have with telecommunications, shipping, air traffic control, many other things. I just want to say that the importance of what you're working on is real. It's very significant, and it's gone from being what I will say a backwater in Arctic research, where the hard scientists, the people looking at ice and the people looking at rocks and the people looking at climate and all of that, I believe that you are now front and center in something that's incredibly important for our future, which is to gauge our progress, which is not forget the people, and which is to help us give direction that can do the one thing that I know we have to keep doing. When Ernest Greening went to a Senate hearing and said, could you give us a little foreign aid? He was looking for investment. When we had a big tax battle in our election last month, the argument is not how much the take is necessarily. The argument is, what do we offer the world in terms of certainty for investment? Because I can tell you that in order to meet the goals that we all have, to educate our children, to have them have jobs here, to be sustainable in our resource development and so forth, we have to be a sponge that soaks up literally hundreds of billions of dollars. Or not. And I'll just tell you, I don't think the or not works. When I go to a village today, ammunition costs a lot of money. The snow machines need gasoline. I don't think we're going back to a non-cash economy. I think we always should and will have a strong subsistence economy. But in the end, I think what's exciting about what's happening today is that a kid can grow up in any place in the Arctic and work on global issues and compete in global commerce and live where he or she want to live. And that to me is exciting. So thank you all for your work, and thanks for the honor of getting the preview of this report. I will tell you that one of the Alaskans who gets to sit on the Arctic Policy Group at the Department of State, there's a little bit of concern this time. Well, this wasn't commissioned by SDWG and so forth, and I wish you luck, and I'll certainly make and call on me to help make the arguments to have governments pay attention to this, because rather than controlling and wanting to make sure that, you know, every word has been approved by ministers from eight nations, I think what's very important is that we keep up the common look, because we have made progress and we have much more progress to make. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a preview of the 2014 Arctic Human Development Report on Addressing Alaskans. The scientists you heard from, in order, were Gail Fondahl, Peter Schweitzer, Lee Husky, Gary Kofinis, Diane Hirschberg, and Andre Petrov. This panel was recorded at the UAA-APU Consortium Library on September 19th. It was hosted by UAA. Thanks for tuning in with us today on Addressing Alaskans. I'm your host and producer, Monica Goki.
Addressing Alaskans is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Patrick Lee. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to our website at alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. Learn more about Addressing Alaskans and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.